Okay, good morning. Let's see, so all right, so let's see, so the my thought for today is to look at the algebraic operations on functions and see how those relate to the spaces of functions that we were looking at so far. All right, and we'll continue to work, of course. All right, and so these are the spaces of functions. These are the algebraic operations that you're familiar with from 21 because they're very useful. Although, in fact, that what we will be more focused on, and of course they are useful, but the fact that these formulas exist at all is what's, in fact, the most interesting fact for us. But in any case, let me just remind you what they are. So algebraic operations on functions. And then the two properties of functions that we care about, which are continuity and differentiability. All right, so those are what we want to see how these operations relate to. Just for some notation, let me just write fun for functions. So fun of R, for example, would be all functions. F, just mapping R to R. These are just a place where all of my function spaces live. All right. And so if we have two such functions, so if F and G are functions, and we have some number, then the operations of interest here are the two that come from linearity. So K times F, if you just multiply it, so this is another function. And actually, maybe I'll just keep a running list of examples just so we have them. So e.g., let me say that g of x is a sine of x, and f of x is 1 over x. Okay, and I realize this is slightly inconsistent, so I have restricted to functions that are defined on R, but I could work with a smaller domain if I wanted to and put it there. That would be fine. And this particular one, of course, has a smaller domain, right? This one is only, oops. This one is only defined where x is non-zero. Right? So that's, okay, just to have an example running along. And so, of course, I have some constant. K is equal to, let's say, 3. Okay, so then I have examples like I can take 3 times sine of x, and that'll be a new function. So that's 3g. Okay, and then the other things, of course, I can do, I can just add them. That's the next easiest thing. And this will be another function. So I could have something like sine of x plus 1 on x will be g plus f. Right, and the other operations of interest are things like multiplication of functions. And so that would be something like 1 over x sine x. And I hope you can tell the difference. I'm going to have a closed circle and an open circle, and they mean different things. So I can compose. I can take a g composed with f. This will be another function. And in this case, that's going to be sine of 1 over x. So that's a g composed with f. Now, this is the first one that's actually not commutative. So if I did it in the other order, then what would I get? So if I take a F composed with G, is it clear what that one is?
It's 1 over sine x.
That's right. So yeah. So which one you plug into which the other one is different, right? Unlike the others. Right, so that's 1 over sine x. Right. So that's the notation. All right. So that's a collection of functions. And from the previous course, you had. Oh, and maybe I'll just remind you of the spaces of functions that we have. Put this over here. So recall the one that I've added new is fun, so all functions. But then contained in there are the continuous functions, which are the ones that were mostly studied. Whoops, in 7a, and then we start looking at derivatives, which is our focus here. So they could be differentiable. They could be continuously differentiable. They could be twice differentiable. And then we even had this infinitely differentiable concept. And that was the same thing as infinitely continuously differentiable. Actually, those were the spaces of the functions that we had. OK, and so the first thing to notice is from a previous fact about continuity, which is that if the theorem, if my functions are continuous, that's just another way to say it. Okay. Then it's also true of these new functions that I get from them. I'm going to go start it this way. So KF, F plus G, F times G, and the composition G with F are in the space of continuous functions. So these are, the new ones are also continuous. Another way to say that. Okay, so that's a handy fact that we had from before. All right. Let's see. Maybe I'll just do a quick example of that. So e.g., if we have capital G continuous at little f of c, and little f is continuous at c, then I can take the limit. Let's see, how should I write it? Let me do it this way. So I can take the well, okay, so then by our statement here, I can take this composition. So F composed with F, oops, so that's, so yeah, I'm trying to make sure that my composed has a hole in the middle so you can tell it apart from multiplying. Okay, so that F, G composed with F is continuous at C. So what does that mean? Well, to be continuous at C just means that the limit as x approaches c of g composed with f at x. So what does it mean to be continuous? It just means that all I have to do is plug in the value, right? And now I can write down the definition. That just means g of f of c if I want. But f, g is continuous. So this is equal to the limit as y approaches something of g of y. And what does y have to approach to make that sentence true. That's correct. Yeah. So does that make sense? Laura has it correct there. So if this G is continuous at f of c, that's the same as saying that the limit as y approaches f of c, the thing that I'm plugging in, is equal to it evaluated at that point. Right. So I just have to put an f of c there. Okay, so this one goes to C, and that one goes to F of C. Okay, so that's a summary. So, and if I would do that over here in my example, that would mean that the limit as X approaches pi of the sine of 1 over X is the same as, well, it's just the sine of 1 over pi, because my function is continuous, but I can also write that as the limit as Y approaches 1 over pi of sine of y. That's all this is saying. Okay, just a summary. Okay, so that's what we had from before. And now we want to add derivatives to the picture. Okay, so and again, these are basically facts that you have been using since you started working with calculus, because they're very handy for actually computing things. But let me just write them down. So, and these are theorems 8.19 and 8.21. But what you should be thinking about is what that says about my spaces of functions up here. These various spaces of functions that are of interest to me. If I apply these operations, I want to know if I stay within them. That's the question I'm going to ask you in a minute, but let me just write down these formulae and you can start thinking about that while I write these down. So let me write it a few different ways. So if we have f and g, this time I want them to be differentiable. So differentiable, and of course a number, just like before. Then I can take k times my function, say f. Oops. And I can take its derivative, and of course that's just k times the derivative. F, or I can also write in terms of differentials. Let me write it that way too. So different ways to write it. So d of kf is equal to k times df. Okay, and I can also write it over here in my example, just so I have an example over here. So three times the sine of x prime is of course just three times the sine prime of x, as is familiar. Okay, so that's the easiest one, is multiplication by a constant. And then just in order of complexity, the next more complicated one is f plus g. And of course that's f prime plus g prime, or if we want in terms of d's, that's a d of f plus g is a df plus a dg. Or over here, if I take one on x plus sine of x prime, of course, I can just do those separately. So it's minus one over x squared plus the cosine of x, right? That's all that means. All right, and so then the next most complicated, and now we are getting to an interesting one, is the product rule, which says that f, and this is a solid dot, f times g prime is equal to, let's put in the space here. So it's going to be f prime times g plus f times g prime, or in terms of these d's, d of f times g is equal to df times g plus f times dg, or in terms of my examples, 1 on x times the sine of x prime is equal to minus 1 over x squared sine of x plus 1 over x cosine of x, right? And let's see, let me add one more that I didn't have above. It's kind of a special case, but it's convenient. And I'll do actually next time some more examples with it. But the quotient rule is a useful one. F over G prime, of course, is F prime times G plus F times, minus F times G prime divided by G squared, or in other words, it looks the same in this D notation. So df times g minus f times dg divided by g squared. And if I were to use an example over here, I would take sine of x over x prime, and that's supposed to be, see how did I write the numerator first over there? So cosine of x times times x minus one times the sine of x divided by x squared. And you subtract that those two are the same thing. Right. Okay, so those are the main rules. And then of course the most interesting one is the chain rule. And that's the one I'm going to prove in a minute. So that one says that G composed with F prime is equal to G prime composed with F times. So here I have to have both the closed open dot and the closed dot, right? Times F prime, or in terms of my D's, D of G composed with F is equal to DG composed with F times DF, right? And over here, if I were to take the sine of one on X prime, that's gonna be the cosine of one over X times minus one over X. Okay, so that should all be familiar. And so, but conceptually, let me just say the way that I picture what we just did. So what did we do? We took a function that was differentiable, and I built a new function out of it, k times it, and I figured out not only was it differentiable, I wrote down what the derivative was. Okay. And then I did that here too. I had these two differentiable functions. I built a new function, and which is the sum, and I tried to figure out its derivative, and I found it. All right. And then I did it again. I took my two functions. I built a new function, tried to find its derivative, and I found it. It had some derivative or other. All right. Similarly, well, this one I'm kind of going to ignore that one for now because it's not as useful right now. And here again, I built a new function, the composition, and I tried to find its derivative, and again I found its derivative. Actually, this let me just mention it so that it's there. What's the restriction I need to make this quotient one work? Yeah, exactly. It's in the chat. Don't want to divide by zero. That's the only problem there. Okay, but all the other ones make sense. All right, so let me just mention then that the corollary of this is corollary. All right, so we have this theorem. It says that I take these two functions that are differentiable, and then I found the derivatives of all these other things, so they're differentiable too. All right, so corollary, if f and g are differentiable, and we have some number, then KF FP plus g, f times g, and g composed with f are also differentiable. Okay, is it clear? That's what I just showed. Okay, that follows immediately from these formulae. Okay, so actually, let me just give you 3 minutes to answer the following question. So, a question. Are the other spaces, so CK of R, DK of R, let me be more precise. So let me say the other function. So I have C1 of R, D2 of R, they just keep going in this order, C2 of R, let me write it that way without the K, and also the smooth ones. So C infinity of R, which we worked out last time, is the same as D infinity of R, also preserved by these operations. Okay. I'll just give you 3 minutes to think about that for a second and see if let's see. I guess you can hear me now. Everyone is looking at whether differentiable and continuous differentiable functions are preserved by products and compositions, etc. So let me just toss you into one of the rooms so you can chat with people for another minute or two. Okay, so just keeping a list here of what my spaces are. All right, so what did people come up with? So let's see, let me just summarize where we were and then you can see what you guys came up with. So we had a way of building new functions from old and we got new functions. So we could multiply by k and we got a new function. We could add, we got a new function. We could multiply and we could compose and we got new functions. Okay, so if I took two functions, then I could build a bunch of new ones. Okay, and we checked in 127a, that if they were continuous, they stayed continuous, all right? So if I had two continuous functions, I could multiply one of them by a constant, I could add them, I could multiply them by each other, or I could compose them, and I still had a continuous function that we worked out. Okay, and then I just claimed that if I start with two differentiable functions, I wrote down a formula over here for what their new derivatives are, so they're still differentiable, okay? And so we still had that, so just now, this is 8.21, it said that these things are again differentiable. Okay, what about continuously differentiable? So what did you guys figure out about the next one? So if I start with two functions that are continuously differentiable and I do these four operations to them, do I end up with functions that are again continuously differentiable? So what would I have to check? Let's just check one thing at a time. So if I multiply it by k, if I take a continuously differentiable function f here, and I look at k times f, okay, and look at its derivative, is that derivative necessarily continuous? That makes sense. So what I'm assuming is that the derivative of f is continuous, right? And then I'm going to take my function f and multiply it by a constant and see whether the derivative of the resulting function is again continuous. Good. Yes is the correct answer. And why is that? Because the derivative of this k times it is given by this formula, and that means it's k times the derivative of f. But if this function derivative of f is continuous, I know that if I multiply a continuous function by a constant, it's still continuous. Okay, so maybe I'll just write that out just so that it's clear what the logic is. So note, if f is in C1 of R, then f prime is continuous. So k times f prime is continuous. So k times f prime, which is exactly the same thing, is also continuous. So, well, having a continuous derivative is the same as saying that it's in C1. So k times f is also in C1. So does that make sense? So that's the sequence of logic. I start with a function which is in my space C1, which just means that its derivative is continuous. And I end up with a new function, k times f, and that one is still in C1. So that's what I want to check. Does that make sense? Okay. So now what about, so let me just summarize where we are. So we've got that if I start with functions in C1 here, then I can multiply them by k and I end up still in something with a continuous derivative. What if I add two functions with continuous derivatives? Then is the derivative of their sum, which I have a formula for over here, is this again going to be a continuous function, this derivative? Yes, right. So this time again, we have this is continuous and this is continuous. And we know from previously, wherever I wrote it, that if you take the sum of two continuous functions, it's still continuous. Right? So that's preserved. So again, summarizing over here, we have that the sum preserves continuity. Okay, and then it gets a little bit more complicated. What about the product? If I take the product of two functions with continuous derivatives, so here's my formula for what the derivative of the product is. Is this right-hand side, is this new derivative, again, a continuous function? Yes, okay, a couple people agree. And why is that? It's several steps, right? Because this function is continuous because my function has a continuous derivative. This function is continuous because every differentiable function is continuous, okay? That means that their product is continuous because the products of continuous functions are continuous. This function, this one has exactly the same argument over here. And so then I've added two continuous functions, so the whole thing is continuous. So that means the derivative of the product is continuous. Does that make sense? So that's the argument. Okay, and then what about the composition? Does that one also work? So there's my formula here for the chain rule. Yes, this one works again, right? Because again, this is gonna be a composition of continuous functions, which is continuous, and this is continuous, and the product of two continuous functions is continuous. So I get something that's continuous again. Okay, so this is also preserved. All right. So did anyone get a chance to think about the next one, about if we have something that's twice differentiable, if it has two derivatives? So if I start up here with some things that have two derivatives, then I want to check whether each of these new functions also has two derivatives. Okay, so maybe I'll just write one of those out so it's clear. So note that so that means that the derivative exists. So if I take k times this, this exists. But that's what that second derivative is. So k times f is twice differentiable. Okay, so that's again the easy one. And then once again, each of these gets more complicated, right? So this one is again not too bad because if I want to take the second derivative here, I just end up with the second derivative of both of those, right? So that still exists. What about here? If I take a second derivative of the product, what do I end up with? Maybe I'll write that one out also just so that it's clear. So note, if we have f and g twice differentiable, then what do I have? So I can compute f times g second derivative. And how do I do that? Well, I just do exactly what you have done in 21. So I first do the first derivative. Then I take the derivative of that. And so now I have to use my product rule and my sum rule. And so I end up with f double prime times g plus f prime times g prime from the first term. And then f prime times g prime plus f times g double prime from the second term. Right, so that's what I get. Okay, and does this exist? So I claim it does. And why is that? Because all I needed to do was take the second derivative. That's the highest derivative I had to take from each one. Okay, since f double prime and g double prime. And so this means that we have the product. Okay, and you can add, you can run through the same thing for the composition, and you'll get that the composition is also preserving the space dt. Okay, and let me just do one more. So what would have happened if instead of D2, I would have put these both in C2? So what's the difference between D2 and C2? It just means that that second derivative is continuous, right? So if that second derivative were continuous, is this second derivative of the product also gonna be a continuous function? Well, we wrote it out. So the question is just whether this is continuous, and is that one continuous? Yeah, it is, right? Because this is continuous and that's continuous. Each of the terms that comes up here is continuous. And so their products and sums are all continuous. So it is again continuous. Okay, so the upside is that if we have F and G in CK or DK, then and K a real number, then K times F, F plus G, F times G, and decompose with F are in CK or RK or DK also. So we have this closure. All right. Okay, well, anyway, so I hope that that is clear. But in any case, let me go now and prove one of these results, and let me prove the chain rule, and then let you play with a similar statement. So, for the chain rule. All right, so we're in the chain rule, so we're going to set things up as we are. So assume that F and G are differentiable. Okay, and I just want to do this computation right here. I want to compare the derivative of their composition to this right-hand side that we know to be the result of the chain rule. So let's just try that. So let's just compute. All right, so I want to take G composed with F prime, and let me evaluate it at some point C. Okay, so by definition, what is this? This is just limit x approaches c of g composed with f evaluated x minus g composed with f evaluated at c divided by x minus c, right? That's just the definition. I just plug whatever whatever my function is that I'm trying to take the derivative of into these two spots in my difference quotient, and that's the definition. So I'm done. All right. And now I want to compute that. Let me see. So first, let me just write out what that is. So that's just the limit as x approaches c of g of f of c, of x, sorry, minus the g of f of c. That's just what it means to be a composition, just the definition. Okay, and so now I have the trick. So what's the interesting thing to do here? Well, I would like to get the derivative of f involved. So if I have this limit, what's the derivative of f look like as a limit? So that's going to be my f of x minus that f of c, right, divided by x minus c. So the trick is I want to insert that. So how do I do that? Well, I want to just multiply by and divide by the same thing. So this is going to be limit x goes to c, and I'm just going to multiply and divide by f of x minus f of c, because that's what I want in the numerator, but I don't want to change anything. So I'm going to divide by f of x minus f of c, and then just leave everything else alone. Okay, and then reshuffle things so that they're in the form that I want. So this is a limit as x goes to c of g of f of x minus g of f of c divided by, I'm going to take the denominator part, f of x minus f of c. And then I have left the numerator f of x minus f of c. And the other piece of my denominator is the x minus c. So that's what I have there. And so then this is equal to the limit as x goes to c of g of the first term here. Actually, maybe I'll just write it that way so I don't, something looks messy. So just the same thing that I had before. And then I'm just gonna split it into the product of these two limits. All right, so now we can try to figure out what these things are. So what is this last limit here? Yeah, that's exactly f prime. That's the definition of f prime. So this last term is going to be the f prime of c, which is also what we wanted. All right. Okay, and so then the only thing left is we can go back and use that trick that I mentioned at the beginning about limits of compositions. And this is the limit of something as x approaches c, but I can now plug in this f of x into g. So let me write it that way. So this is equal to the limit as y approaches f of c, okay, and where I put in y for f of x, okay, and then just leave the rest alone. Okay, so this one's a little bit harder to see, but can anyone see what this value is? Again, this is some kind of a difference quotient, right? Where I have a limit as y approaches some value of g of y minus g of that value over y minus that value. So what is that equal to? Yeah, it's g prime of f of c, right? Because it's the derivative, it's just the normal derivative, except instead of the name for the thing that I'm taking the derivative at, instead of calling it A or B or something, I'm calling it f of c. It's just its name, right? Because I have this f of c here, and f of c here, right? So then we're done. So this is then equal to g prime of f of c times f prime of c, which was our goal. Okay, so let's see. So any questions about that outline for a proof? So maybe I'll just quickly run through. So where would this have to be tightened up to make it an exact proof? So why can I do this? Why can I split it into two limits? So this works as long as both of the limits exist. Okay, it could be that one of them exists and the other doesn't, and the original one does. That's possible. But as long as both of the new ones exist, then I'm fine. Okay, and so that's true down here. So that's all right. Let's see. The other thing is here I have to be a little bit careful. What could be a problem with multiplying and dividing by the same thing?
Is it like if both were zero? So like if that would
be exactly zero. Very good. That's exactly the problem. It could be that they're both zero, and you have to be make a do a little song and dance to get around that problem to do it correctly. Careful about f of x minus f of c equal to zero, or in other words, f of x equals f of c, and the problem is that that might happen even if x is different from c. You might have a function where that happens, so you have to be a little bit careful to deal with that. Okay, but I'm not going to write out the details of fixing that. It takes a bit of time. All right, so any questions about that proof? Okay, then I want to introduce one more thing for you to think about, and next time I'll have you work out something about it, but and that is to the think about parameterized curves. And this is going to come up when we prove L'Hopital's rule in a week or two. So okay, so the picture I have is something like this. I have a curve, and it needn't be a function anymore, okay? And I have it parameterized. So this is going to be x of t. And that's going to be y of t. Okay, and I want to look at the following limit. So claim, and this is what I'm going to ask you to prove next time, the limit as s approaches t of the change in y, so y of s minus y of t over the change in x of s minus x of t. I claim that another way to get that is to take the derivative y prime of t and divide it by the derivative x prime of t, except, so what could go wrong here? What's the one case I have to deal with? Yeah, x prime better not be zero. Okay, and in this case, this is also the slope of the tangent line to the curve at that point. This is the slope of the tangent line to the curve at the point. X of t, y of t. Okay, so for example, if I'm take this curve and I'm traversing it, so you realize that the graph doesn't tell me everything. It doesn't tell me what the value of t is at that point. So it could be that I'm traversing it very quickly. It could be that I'm traversing it very slowly. It could be that I stop along the way. And so those that information is not encoded in the graph, right? That would be encoded in the formulas for x of t and y of t, but not in the graph. And as such, let me just ask one more question before we stop here. So question, and think about it a second, try to answer here. So question, what can this slope be of the tangent line uh, If this is the problem case, so x prime of t is equal to zero. So the horizontal speed of my curve at that point is zero. So just spend a second there and see if you can think of what that would be. And feel free to share it in the chat answer. Yeah, vertical, that's good. Actually, undefined is also possible. It can happen. In fact, I didn't draw an example of it, but it could be that your curve looks kind of like this, and it stops there, and you don't have a slope. That's possible. Vertical is, I think, the most common situation. That's the right intuition. So vertical is most common. Could be undefined, could be a corner or a cusp, but not defined. But it's certainly true that if I'm traversing this curve along, my horizontal speed, even if I'm moving pretty fast, my horizontal speed is zero there, right? So it's so that vertical one is going to have dx equals zero. There's but it's also possible that it's neither of those and how could that happen? So if I traverse along here, something like this, so again, the other thing to look at is if I have this situation here, it could be that this derivative is zero, right? It could be an intersection. That's right. That can happen. Actually, that's kind of invisible to the parameterized curve. The parameterized curve can't really tell that it's an intersection. As long as it's moving at a good speed, I'll get at that point will be hit at two different times. And if I plug in the one time, I'll get this one. And if I plug in the other time, I'll get this one. So that that one actually works pretty well as long as the speed is non-zero at in both times that you cross through that point. So that that one will give you the right answer typically. But the other thing that happens, I can stop. Okay, so it could be that I'm parameterizing it along and then it just stops for a while and then it continues and then it stops and then it continues, right? So what's that gonna do? That's gonna mean that x prime is zero and what's y prime gonna be? Zero also, right? So I'll end up with a zero over zero, right? But the slope could be anything, okay? As if I just stop there. So it could be any other slope if x prime over y prime is zero over zero. Y prime over x prime. Okay, anyway, so next time I'll ask you to run through the proof of this first part. And I am out of time, somewhat out of time. And so I will stop the recording and I'll stick around for a while if there are questions. Have a nice weekend.